You'll notice that the PowerPoints changed just a little bit, and I did that purposely. I got tired of looking at why people don't want to believe, and I bet you did too. So we're moving on to look at the identity of Jesus, and so the handout I've given you this evening will give us a little rough draft of where we're headed and where we're going. The identity of Jesus. We did quite a bit of studying as to the examining that he is a historical person. Just like to turn, if you will, to John chapter 7. John chapter 7. Now we're going to be looking at this a little bit later. But this is the time of the Feast of the Tabernacle. And during this time, in John chapter 7, we have the reading of the account that is just before the Feast of Tabernacles. And at this time, the Jews were seeking to kill Jesus, verse 1. And so his brother said to him, "Leave and go from here and go into Judea, so that your disciples will be able to see your works and see what you're doing. For no one knows, for no one does anything in secret when he himself sees or seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show it yourself to the world." Well, he sends them on, verses 6, 7, and 8, and sends them on, and then he comes later, verse 10. But I want to draw your attention to verse 11 and following. "So the Jews were seeking him," speaking of Jesus, "at the feast, and they were saying, 'Where is he?' And there was much grumbling among the crowds concerning Jesus. Some were saying, 'What? He's a good man.' And others were saying, 'No, on the contrary, he leads people astray.' Yet no one was speaking openly of him for fear of the Jews." So I draw that passage to your attention just to remind us that the reality of Jesus is a fact. And the people of the day were wrestling with it just like the rest of us should be. Who is Jesus? Well, for the next few weeks, Lord willing, we're going to look at how he describes himself and at the same time how he describes the Father. So, the identity of Jesus. We have looked at the historical reality of Jesus. We looked at the claim of we are looking at the claim of his divinity. We had a short pause there that was maybe a little bit too long, looking at why people have a hard time accepting Jesus. And then finally, we'll look at the testimony for the divinity of Jesus from others. This screen you've seen before, and before I've added the underline just to reinforce for us that Christianity, and this is a silly statement, Christianity is all about Jesus. What does it mean to be a Christian if it wasn't about Jesus? That's a silly statement. But be it as it may, I do think that Michael Green did have a good thought when he said it's all about the Jesus of history, remove him from Christianity, and nothing distinctive is left. What is religion without Jesus? Well, make your list of do's and don'ts, have a planning session and do some partying, and what else? There's nothing else to religion if you remove Jesus from the equation. Religion falls apart like a deck of cards. Well, we've looked at that again. I've been trying to bring to your attention every time each week we've looked at this, about the acid test. The acid test. I think it's a critical thought that whatever is written concerning Jesus is written in the context of a space-time dimension, providing the reader with checkpoints for confirmation. What I mean is, and like I've illustrated before, that if I were to tell you something about Ed Stevens, you would be able to say, "Who are you talking about? That's not the Ed I know," and be able to correct me. Correct? Well, I can't help it. He's got a handicapped golf average. I don't know, Ed. I don't know that much about golf. I don't know if that's good or bad.
But you know what I'm trying to say, and the illustration I'm giving, is that you can prove or disprove or correct the statements that are incorrect if they are in a time-space dimension. So that we came to the conclusion when we talked about the reality of Jesus, that the man Jesus actually lived, that he did many wonderful works, just like we looked at here in John chapter 7. Many people said that he was a wonderful man. The Gospels meet the acid test as to being able to determine the teaching and the actions of Jesus. The Gospels contain the only record, plus Paul's writings, of what Jesus actually said and did. And finally, the Gospels are our most timely records from this time frame. Well, what is Jesus' claim? Pretty plain, isn't it? He said, I don't do anything on my own initiative, but as my Father has given me instruction, so I give you. So we want to be taking a few weeks and look at the identity of Jesus, particularly in regards to the I Ams. And I chose to begin with light. What was the first thing that was created? Verse 3, and then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that light was good, and he separated light from darkness. Well, light is nothing new. And as we look at this passage tonight, just want to remind us that it was used throughout the Old Testament, the concept of light and the concept of darkness. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, what? Let your light so shine among men. What? You are the light of among men. Passage I'm thinking of is Matthew chapter 5 and verse 16. Light is used to describe God. Jesus says, I am light of the world. He also says, using the definition of light, that light, that Christians are to be the light unto the world, Philippians chapter 2 and verse 15. Light unto the world. So, the concept of light is nothing that is new, but just want to wrestle with the thought of what light is. I want to wrestle with it because one gentleman wrote, speaking about light, he said there are types of so-called religious apologetic, which, distrusting the intrinsic claims of religion itself, seek to try to put into place external evidences and institutional safeguards. What's he saying? There's some element among those who are claiming to be believers that don't believe unless there is a third outside source that props up the Bible. Does the Bible need to be propped up? No. We've already shown that it was more historically accurate than anything else that is available. But how can light convince us that it is light, except for by what it does for us? We do not demonstrate that light is light by treatises or by analysis of its contingent rays. It is only light to us when it illumines and quickens us. He also says, anyone can, in his own satisfaction, confute the claim which beauty makes, saying, I do not see it, or claim inherent goodness by saying, I do not hear it, or by self-evidencing nature of truth by saying, I don't know it. But man does not create goodness or truth or beauty. And to say that he cannot see them is to condemn himself and not the light. What did all that say? Well, first of all, it means not much. because it's one man's statement, right? But what he is getting down to is just because people can't see the light doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. We see beauty. We know what goodness is. We need to also know what the light is. What we need to understand is that light in and of itself is not generated from man. Now, is that a heavy thought? Man cannot generate light from himself. Not at all. No, not even when I take out the flashlight. I didn't create it. What happened? The electrons and the batteries came together, and they are what? Sparking the firmament in the bulb, and that is causing light, right? Well, we understand what light is. We understand what light is all around us. But what is Jesus trying to say? He's saying that I am the burning? No, not at all. Rather, what does he say about light? Let's look at John chapter 1, verses 4 and 5. In the discussion and the introduction of Jesus, we understand that in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God and the Word was God. Correct? We don't always go down to verses 4 and 5. In Him, speaking of the Word, was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. Verse 6 through 11. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness of the light, that although all through him might believe. Boy, I have to read that and twice to make sure I understand. There was a man sent by God, sent from God, whose name was John. This man came for a witness of the light that all through him might believe. John was not pointing at himself. He was pointing at who? He kept saying, I am not the Messiah. I am not worthy to untie his sandals. Correct. He kept teaching people to repent. Why? The Messiah is coming. Repent, Messiah is coming. He is here. He was not the light, but was sent to bear witness of the light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man who comes into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. Who is the light? Jesus. But they didn't comprehend it. Well, there's a thought here of what we're going to talk about, and we've only got just 15 minutes to do it. So I'd like for you to turn over to John chapter 7 again. John chapter 7. John chapter 7, Jesus is going down to the Feast of Tabernacles. What is the Feast of Tabernacles? When is it held? What's its significance? The 7th month, 15th to 22nd. I pulled a book, and again, it's just another man's thoughts. But the reason I pulled this book is it is the life of Jesus, the Messiah, the life and times of Jesus, the Messiah, by Edersheim. Edersheim. To give us an example or give us an understanding of what happened during the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. You said it was the 7th month. Yes, indeed it was. Talked about that the light lumens and qualifies. In book 4, chapter 6, this is what I'd like to share with you concerning the Feast of Tabernacles. It is early on the 14th of Shishra, according to our September or early October, all the festive pilgrims have arrived. Then it was indeed a scene of bustle and activity. Hospitality had to be sought and found. Guests were to be welcomed and entertained, and all things required for the feast to be got ready. Above, all booths had to be erected everywhere, and in the courts and on the housetop, in the street and in the square, and dwellings for lodgment and for entertainment of the vast multitude. Leafy dwellings everywhere, to remind of the wilderness journey and now of the goodly land. Only the fiery castle Antonia, this is in the city of Jerusalem, which frowned above the temple, was undecked by the festive spring into which the land had been burst. To the Jew, it must have been a hateful sight, that castle which guarded and dominated his own city and temple. Hateful sight and sounds, that Roman garrison, with its foreign heathen, its ribald speech, and its manners. Yet for all of this, Israel could not read on the lowering sky the signs of the times, nor yet knew the day of their merciful visitation. And this, although all the festivals that of the tabernacles should have most clearly pointed them to the future. Indeed, the whole symbol of the feast, beginning with the completed harvest, for which it was a thanksgiving, pointed to the future. The rabbis themselves admitted this. The strange number of sacrificial bullocks, 70 in all, they regarded as referring to the 70 nations of heathendom. The ceremony of the outpouring of water, which was considered of such vital importance as to give to the whole festival the name of the House of Outpouring, was symbolical of the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. As the brief night of the great temple illumination closed, there was a solemn testimony made before Jehovah against heathenism. It must have been a stirring scene when from out of the masses of Levites with their musical instruments who crowded the 15 steps that led from the court of Israel to that of the court of the women, stepped two priests with their silver trumpets. As the first crock crowing and intimated the dawn of morn, they blew a threefold blast, another on the 10th step and another on the 15th. And another threefold blast as they entered the court of the women. And still sounding their trumpets, they marched through the court of women to the beautiful gate. Here, turning round and facing the westwards of the holy place, they repeated, saying, "Our fathers who were in this place." They turned their backs on the sanctuary of Jehovah and their faces eastward, for they worshipped eastward the sun. But our eyes are on Jehovah. We are Jehovah's. Our eyes are on Jehovah. No, the whole of this whole night and morning scene was symbolic. The temple illumination of the light, which was to shine out from the temple into the dark night of heathendom. Then at the first dawn of morning, the blast of the priest's silver trumpets and the army of God. As it is advanced with its festive trumpet call to awaken the sleepers. Marching on to the quite utmost bounds of the sanctuary, to the beautiful gate which opened upon the court of the Gentiles. And then again facing the utter solemn protest against heathenism and to make solemn confession of Jehovah. Well, what does that mean? Hopefully that just kind of painted a little bit of a picture. This time, this Feast of Tabernacles was an important feast for all of Israel. It was a time when people came to Jerusalem to worship God. Edersheim mentions that there was 70 bullocks that was sacrificed. There were 345 priests that were on duty just for the purpose of sacrifices during this festival, plus the supporting staff. What I'm trying to paint to you is this was not just a hapchance gathering. This was a time when all of Israel sat up and took notice and was thankful because the harvest was in. You from the boot hill, you understand that time. Even though Gallup had no harvest, living in the plains, southern plains, understand that is when my uncle bought his truck. His trucking camp, that was the time when the money was there. That was the time of celebration. So this is the time when Jesus comes into the city, and he says in chapter 7, verse 14, "And now it was in the midst of the feast, and Jesus went up to the temple and began to teach. The Jews then were astonished, saying, 'How has this man become so learned, having never been educated?'" And the Jews were astonished, saying, "How has this man..." Oh, okay, I already read that, didn't I? Verse Verse 16, and Jesus answered them and said, the teaching's not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone is willing to do his will, and he will know of the teaching, whether it is of God or whether it I speak of from myself. Verse 18, he who speaks from himself seeks his own glory. But he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there is no unrighteousness in him. But did not Moses give you the law? And yet none of you carries out the law. Why do you seek to kill me? Oh, contrary, verse 20, where no one is seeking to kill you, you must have a demon. Verse 21, Jesus continues, I did one deed, and yet you all marvel. And for this reason, Moses has given you circumcision. Not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath, you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath so that the law of Moses will not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to your appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. We're going to pause there just for a quick second, because I believe that Jesus, here in this place, in the Feast of Tabernacles, the place of where people came together, which was the courtyard of the women, of the temple. Jesus is speaking, and he is telling them, wake up. You don't keep the law. You are all law breakers. You see, there's something about light. It illuminates. It shows where we are. That's a good thing. That is a good thing. When vacationing on the West Fork of the Dolores River and having to make the trip down to the facility room, that was the outhouse. And there was bushes and there was other things along the way. It was good to have a light because it showed us where we were going. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. I am the light. He continues on his discussion, but there's a couple thoughts here that we just want to kind of get to. One of the things is that the Jews are claiming that he did not use judgment. Did not use judgment. With what judgment do you judge? And then we get into chapter 8. And in the first 11 verses of chapter 8, is a familiar story which you are well known. Because a woman was brought that was caught in adultery. We know that it takes more than one to commit adultery. But here was a woman that was caught in the act of adultery, and the Jews are seeking Jesus to condemn her and to stone her to death according to the law. And we know how Jesus responded. Ye who without sin cast the first stone. Now, there was some religious commentators that think that this event should not be at this location in the book of John. But I believe it does. Because here is the very thing that Jesus is trying to teach. I am from God. I am light. See the contrast. See the contrast. You know, as a child and I was coloring in the coloring book, what is the first lesson you teach children coloring in a coloring book? I'm hearing it from four or five different sources. Stay within the lines. Why are there lines there? So that you learn how to draw. So that you learn how to color, right? And when you get outside the line, what happens? It shows up like a big boo-boo, doesn't it? Well, light shows the difference. Light shows the difference. Chapter 8. Jesus said in verse 12, I am the light of the world, and he who does not follow me does not walk according, or he who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life. And so the Pharisees were saying to him, you're testifying about yourself. Your testimony cannot be accepted. It is not legal. It is not true. No one can have testimony about themselves unless it's supported by another. Remember Leviticus chapter 19. We looked at the passage several weeks ago. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, testimony is made sure. Verse 14, even if I testify about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I am going. But you do not know where I come from or where I am going. You judge according to the flesh. But I'm not judging anyone. But even verse 16, but even if I do judge, my judgment is true, for I am not alone in it, but I and the Father who sent me. Even in your law, it has been written that on the testimony of two is made sure. I am he who testifies about himself, and the Father who sent me testifies about me. Oh, verse 19, they got the drift. They got the concept of what he was saying, verse 19. Where's your Father? You know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. Ah, Jesus is the light of the world. Because through him, we see the Father. He is the exact representation of the Father. What is Jesus saying? Light illuminates. It shows what is there. And it quickens. A plant that is kept in the dark, unless it's a fungi, does not thrive. Light illuminates and quickens. What is Jesus saying? He is qualified to testify about who he is, and Jesus is from the Father. Those two points is what Jesus is trying to get across to people in chapter 7 and chapter 8 of the book of John. I am qualified, and I am from the Father. Those are the two lessons that I believe Jesus would have us to learn when he says, I am the light. Next week, Lord willing, we'll look at the bread of life.